Now it's time for our Sunday group. As you've probably heard by now, a power-saving campaign kicks off today, encouraging us, some would say a bit tentatively, to switch off lights and take shorter showers. So we thought it was a good time to talk about the security of the nation's electricity supply. Our heavy dependence on hydropower makes us vulnerable to the vagaries of the weather gods, but how much of a threat does that pose to our well-being and our economy? Should we be looking at more reliable but inevitably more costly alternatives? Well, to talk about all of this, on Friday I was joined by consultant Tony Baldwin, Trustpower's Community Relations Manager Graham Purchase, and Ralph Mathis from the Major Electricity Users Group.
Do we have a crisis, Tony?
Is there a crisis? No, it's not. It wouldn't be the correct word to use the word crisis. We've got a very severe lack of rain. We've had the lowest inflows into the Southern Lakes over the last 3 months since about 1931. So we've got a real change in climate that's happened over the summer, and we all know we had a wonderful summer, but it means that it's quite hard to generate electricity in the winter.
We seem to make a meal of this whole business of whether it will or could be or is inevitably going to be a crisis in which we're going to be asked to save more and more. We don't seem to have learned very much, Ralph, do we, over the last decade or so? We use it to excess, then all of a sudden it doesn't rain, and oh my God, there's going to be a crisis, and then the government says, no, it's not really a crisis. We don't seem to have learned a damn thing.
Well, I don't think that's strictly correct. I tend to agree with Tony that this isn't a crisis. To me, a crisis is when we run out of options, and asking the public to save is actually one of the options we've got.
That's what I meant, essentially. Yeah. We don't seem willing to do this more rigorously.
Yeah, but I think if you go back and look at what happened in 2001 and 2003 in particular, we did learn some lessons from that experience. There wasn't good information between the generators or with the generators and the demand side as to what the actual situation was, for example, with coal supplies. Mm. The Electricity Commission has now improved all of that. There's a lot more communication. There's a lot more goodwill between suppliers and consumers about doing something to make sure that we don't get to the point of running out or having to ask the public for voluntary savings. So I'm quite optimistic about the trend. Perhaps it's just not moving fast enough in terms of what we need to do to get the market working better.
Well, how much better can it work, Graham?
Well, I think we need to go back a step here. I mean, New Zealand is a very fortunate country in respect that it's got a decent percentage of its generation coming from renewables, from hydro, a little bit of wind and some geothermal. And that means that in real terms, New Zealand's electricity is a lot cheaper than in most of the developed world. Now, the alternative is to have all of your generation or a large hunk of your generation coming from, you know, oil, gas, nuclear, coal, whatever. And then you put yourself at the risk of international commodity markets. So I think New Zealand has to accept that if you're going to have cheaper than most electricity prices, then you have to accept that there will be some years in which you have to tighten the belt. But there are things that we can do to make it better. For example, the South Island is 100% hydro. Now, hydro and wind go very well together. When the wind's blowing, you can store the water to use it later. So there's good opportunities to improve the situation in the South Island simply by adding a decent amount of hydro down there. In the North Island, there's lots of untapped geothermal, and I think that's a good option for the North Island.
All right. Look, I want to come back to this whole business of compatibility of various forms of generation, because there seems to be confusion out there about, for instance, the compatibility of hydro and wind. But how does the system work? The Electricity Commission conducts a review of the situation each year. How does it work from there, and what's its mandate in that respect? Ralph?
Well, the Electricity Commission is required, in terms of the government policy statement, to each year review what the forthcoming security will be for next winter and the I think it's the next two winters after that.
Yeah.
And that's estimated using quite sophisticated forecasting models, as you'd be sort of expect. There's a lot of transparency around those models, so everybody knows what the assumptions that go into them. And, of course, with modelling, there's always sort of a degree of uncertainty about that. And that's quite a transparent process. I guess you sort of have to ask the question, did they get it wrong compared to their forecast just prior to Christmas and what actually happened? Not necessarily. I mean, the current events are actually within the scope of what's happened in the previous 88 years anyway. I mean, there was always a risk that we were going to get to the situation that we're in. So in terms of the Electricity Commission's forecasting, yes, there's room for improvements, no doubt about it. And we're learning too. Some of the measures that we in the Commission have been using need to be improved. For example, we don't have much emphasis on how much capacity we have coming up for the winter. There's always been a focus on energy. So,
what's the difference? Just explain the difference.
Well, with capacity, what you're looking at is how much energy is demanded every half hour.
Yes.
Compared to how much is possible to be supplied every half hour. Whereas with energy, what you're looking at is the actual demand over a whole period, for example, over a whole day or a month, compared to the supply over a day or a month.
Yes.
So that sort of capacity versus energy used. It's sort of like your car might have a sort of 110 brake horsepower. That's your capacity, but you only ever use it on average at about probably 80 or 90 mm-hmm. brake horsepower over a month or whatever. Yeah.
The trigger point at which the standby generation, the Whirinaki station, diesel-powered station, comes into play has become quite complicated, Tony, in recent times, hasn't it? And because the price of diesel has been rising, you've got this higher threshold, and it's got us into a certain amount of shtuck in recent times, hasn't it?
Yes, well, the government and the commission control Whirinaki, so it's a reserve power station, just to explain to listeners, that is supposed to come on when water's low.
Yeah.
And the trigger point is when the price of power is around 20 cents a unit, or the cost of the fuel, whichever's the higher for Whirinaki. So Whirinaki is now running on diesel, and the fuel costs about 35 cents a unit. So it's running flat out. And it's supposed to come in when the water levels get below a thing called the min zone. So
yes.
Another thing that's part of the role of the commission is that they decide how much minimum amount of water we need to keep in our lakes to survive the rest of the winter
mm-hmm.
If we have the lowest amount of rainfall we've had in the last 60 years. If it's worse than that, then we have to do some conservation.
Yeah,
and Whirinaki comes in to try and hold our water supply in stock.
Graham Purchase, if you look at the spread of generating capacity, apart from hydro, we've got a certain amount of thermal stuff, coal, oil, gas. That much of that is pumping it as hard as it can go at stations like where Huntly. New Plymouth, Stratford, places like that. We're out at the maximum end of our ability to pump from thermal, produce power from thermal stations, aren't we? There are a whole lot of reasons, largely related to the environment and carbon and all that, which we needn't go into, which I think most people understand, which are going to inhibit the thermal capacity in future. Where do we go from there?
Well, one of the issues, of course, is not the actual generation itself. It's the ability to get the power from where it's generated to where it's needed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no doubt at all that over a large number of years, there has been a huge underinvestment in the national grid. So, you know, while if you go back to Whirinaki, for example, I think Trustpower's always been of the view that it was a pretty dumb idea for the government to put in a standby plant. It effectively distorts the market, and it's a disincentive for anyone else to build any generation. And not only that, it was built in the wrong place, for goodness sake. You can't get all of its output out because of grid constraints. So I think there's a combination of things. You know, it's interesting, if you look in recent weeks at the way the market's functioning, there's more bids being put in for power than are actually being is actually being sold. So there's not a shortage of actual generation. There's an inability in some places to get it where you need it, when you need it. And I think generation development and development of the grid have to go hand in hand.
If you look at the immediate future, it's quite clear that we're going to need considerably more wind, and opinions differ as to how much more generating, how many more hundreds of megawatts of wind we need to inject into the system. But if we were able, Ralph Mathis, to inject another 500 or 600 megawatts, say, of wind energy, this would effectively remove the problem more or less completely, wouldn't it? Assuming they were compatible with the grid and all that, they won't be built if they're not.
Oh, I think it's, yes, if you did add another 500 or 600 megawatts of wind generation, along with the caveats which you spoke of, which were additional transmission, and of course you'd have to have some backup, you'd have to have some gas-fired power stations available when the wind doesn't blow, because as we've seen over this autumn, there have been long periods where New Zealand's had a sort of a high-pressure zone over it, and there's been no wind anywhere. So once you start to add all those things up, the cost goes up. Mm. And I think you have to get into perspective that when you're talking about sort of maybe 500 or 600 megawatts of wind, that's more than double all of the existing wind farms in New Zealand. And we've got options already with thermal. For example, we have the Otahuhu C power station site in Auckland, which is already consented. Now, that's a 400 megawatt base load combined cycle gas turbine option, which if we had gas, we could actually employ straight away and would be a lot lower cost than wind. I'm not saying that wind...
Even with the carbon trading regime?
Well, that's really up to the developers. The developers will have to make a punt as to where those carbon prices are going to go.
Mm.
There will be a break-even at which point gas-fired turbines aren't profitable. And I think that's the correct thing. If they get the right economic signal with a carbon charge, then you go for wind, or you go for geothermal or hydro or whatever. But I'm not sort of anti-wind. It's just I think you have to add up all the costs and look at all the other options as well.
I think you've got to remember that the South Island at the moment is the most important place to get wind. And realistically, if there'd been 400 or 500 megawatts of wind in the South Island 12 months ago, the South Island hydro lakes would not be in the condition they're in now. Mm. That's the reality. I agree that wind's not going to be the saviour in the North Island. It'll help, but it won't be the saviour. But in the South Island, it will be the saviour because it's a perfect partner for wind.
Unless it doesn't blow.
Yes, but when it doesn't blow, when it is blowing, you're not running down your hydro at the rate you otherwise would be. And when it doesn't blow, you can then use the hydro that you've backed up.
Yeah.
I mean, our Waipori scheme, for example, funnily enough, I was looking at the numbers yesterday, the lake level at Mahinerangi is exactly the same today that it was the same time in 2003. So while it's low, it's not unusual for it to get down to this level. But if we'd have had 100 megawatts or 200 megawatts of wind available a year ago, it'd probably be closer to half full right now, and that would be a huge benefit.
David Cagle was saying the other day that the compatibility of wind and hydro is pretty good. I mean, if you've got a series of wind farms or complexes around the country, it's going to be blowing somewhere or other quite strongly almost all the time. I mean, you may have exceptional periods where there's virtually nothing, but that is truly exceptional. It's going to be blowing somewhere where good wind energy resources exist most of the time. Therefore, there is a compatibility between wind and hydro which is tailor-made for this country, isn't it? Yes,
I think Graham's right. I think there is a synergy between hydro and wind, and we should be exploiting that as much as we can. But I think, and Graham also mentioned that could be a solution for the South Island, but definitely in the North Island, which is where most of the demand growth will be.
Mm.
I think we have to keep our options open around all types of generation. The other thing about the South Island, I mean, if you're looking pretty long term here, we do have a lot of lignite resources in Southland, and coal gasification and carbon sequestration. That may be a couple of decades away, but I think that perhaps should be a longer-term option too.
Well, yes, and I guess a number of countries are just biding their time until that technology is available and affordable and acceptable in emissions terms. I guess this country can afford to do that as well.
There is another issue, though, and that's about building new generation in places where the current demand exceeds the capacity of generation that's anywhere near their doorstep. For example, the west coast of the South Island currently imports about 70% of its electricity. Yeah. And at peak demand is 20% of the juice that goes in on the Canterbury side of the main divide doesn't come out the other end. And I keep using the analogy to west coasters because they understand these things pretty well. I said, imagine a beer tanker that leaves Christchurch and it's got 1,000 litres of beer in it, and it gets to Greymouth and it's only got 800 litres left because it's got a slow leak. You guys pay for 1,000 litres to get 800 litres to drink, and it's the same with electricity. So I think we have, and that's just wasteful. That energy, the 20% of that energy that's being lost should be available somewhere.
How do you eliminate that waste?
Well, we're trying to build hydro on the west coast to make the west coast self-sufficient. We're doing exactly the same in Marlborough. We're trying to build hydro in Marlborough, which instead of having the Marlborough region importing 85% of its electricity, it'll actually generate 85% of it. So I think we need to look closely at doing those sort of things as well.
How good are we at planning for more distributed energy systems? I mean, the Parliamentary Commission for the Environment has been on about this for years, saying, for goodness sake, look at the geography of this place. This country is made for distributed energy systems. Why are we not doing it?
Well, I think some of us are trying to do it, but it's not an easy row to hoe. Like, if you take the west coast, we've been trying to build hydro over there since 2000. We're now in a resource consent process, and it's now going reasonably smoothly. In the Wairau Valley in Marlborough, 2005, we lodged a resource consent after more than 2.5 years of consultation and stuff. In June last year, we got an interim resource consent. Early this year, we went through a couple of month long process to have another hearing to determine conditions. We're still waiting on the conditions, and the whole thing's already been appealed to the Environment Court. So it's going to be at least another 18 months before we're in a position to sit down and say, are we able to build it or not?
I'm talking to Tony Baldwin, Ralph Mathis and Graham Purchase about our ability to produce enough power. Isn't it likely that we're going to see the government calling in major projects increasingly in the future? I mean, Graham's just been talking about the delays and the ability of people to stop the clock on even renewable energy projects, which have everything going for them. If you're clever enough, you can stop the show on just about any project. Are we going to see more, Tony, call-ins?
Yes,
is it inevitable?
The government's already indicated that it intends to call in two proposals, geothermal in the Taupo areas. And certainly the problem of weighing local environmental effects with, I guess, national benefits is always a challenge for a regional authority to deal with. So I think almost certainly that will be the case.
And we will see more as a result? Are we likely to see more hydro projects go ahead? How much more scope is there for hydro in this country?
My understanding is that there is significant scope for additional hydro. And Graham's mentioned a number of the smaller schemes, but I believe that there are also a number of larger schemes to more fully utilise the Lower Waitaki, for example, what was called Project Aqua, the same on the Lower Clutha. In my personal view, it makes more sense to use significant rivers that are already substantially modified and dammed than to change rivers that are undammed and maybe more environmentally sensitive. But That's a personal view.
But there
are smaller stuff, of course, you don't have to dam rivers. And I think you can achieve a very good balance where you're able to leave a sustainable flow in the river, take some of the water out, use it for generation and poke it back in further downstream. And I think there are a good number of those sort of opportunities in New Zealand.
But Graham, I'd challenge you on the notion that a region becomes self-sufficient in power, that notion that the West Coast or the Marlborough would be self-sufficient. I mean, on a national grid basis, that doesn't really occur. The region always needs to be connected to the grid and it needs to pay for access to back up power.
The grid itself is the kind of jewel in the crown. And from what you say, there is no real opportunity to be completely free of a link with the national grid. For instance, in the West Coast, or in Nelson Marlborough.
Practice, absolutely not.
But if you go back to the West Coast example again, yes, there'll always have to be a grid and you always have to have some backup. But, I mean, you go and talk to West Coast businesses about the number of times in the last 12 or 18 months they've suffered from outages due to grid failures. And, you know, if they'd had local generation sufficient to meet the local demand, they simply wouldn't have had those outages. They might have been a short blip, but they wouldn't have had those outages, and they cost West Coast businesses millions of dollars. So, and that's, of course, not forgetting the fact that they're already paying more than they need to because of transmission losses. Yeah. So I think it's important that we do build that generation close to demand.
Well, how and where? Ralph?
I tend to agree with Graham that we do need to build more generation close to where the demand is. And it needs to be, and there's sort of a mixture of both generation and transmission. If you look at the West Coast example, you can probably build a generation scheme a lot quicker than you can a transmission scheme because you've got all sorts of land access problems with transmission. So I tend to think that we do need to build more generation close to load. The Auckland example is pretty insightful too. For example, just what we're going through with the 400 kV pylons going up to Auckland through the Waikato, that's a really long process, lots of protests, whereas if we built some power stations in Auckland, probably would sort of just fly through.
Would it? What and where?
Well, there is a consented site already at Otahuhu C for another power station sitting existing to the existing Otahuhu B power station.
Gas fired. Tony?
Chris, overall, I think you could say that New Zealand's not lacking in energy supply or energy sources. You know, it's a relatively energy-rich country. There are some real issues around permission to build these things. And, of course, there's a very strong not-in-my-backyard syndrome that applies, whether it's wind at Makara or down in Otago or on, you know, the lower Waitaki Project Aquascheme. Everyone wants to have power security. They want low prices. They don't want to have any rationing, but they don't want new generation in their backyard. So it's a bit of a dilemma that the public needs to kind of get its head around a bit more. And it's a paradox. How can you have, you know, good security supply at low price but not have extra generation because you don't like the impact of it?
Do we need... I mean, I remember in the 70s and 80s, I think, we had a power plan and there were... It provided for new projects. It was open. It was on the table. Everybody could look at it. Do we need to go back to something like that? Ralph? I can see you shaking your head vigorously.
Yeah. No, I don't think... I mean, the power plan was part of a sort of a centralised government-run supply chain. And in my view, there has been definite benefits by separating the various components of that supply chain, isolating the transmission system, which is a monopoly, from the potentially competitive systems. Setting up competing suppliers, all of that I think has been good news in terms of driving costs down and trying to get a bit more flexibility around the product supply. So, no, I definitely wouldn't want to go back to sort of having energy plans and central planning.
Chris, it's interesting that that power cuts and shortages occurred with much greater frequency in the 40s, 50s, and indeed the 70s. There were 4 years in the 70s where we had power cuts. So the
as a result of transmission breakdowns?
Or lack of supply.
No,
or lack of supply. Yep. So, go ahead.
Yeah.
The fascinating thing is that, you know, the people who are loudly calling now for a return to central planning seem to have very, very short memories, because, you know, under central planning, we probably had problems that are as bad, if not worse, than what we've got now.
It's interesting also to bear in mind that the last big problem we had in 92, there was a big shortage then, and that was a centrally planned period. The government set up a commission of inquiry that was headed by a Chief Justice to find out what went wrong and what needed to change. And it was those recommendations that gave rise to the way things work now, which is you need to have a spot price, yes. You need to have some contracts, and you need to have much more transparency about fuel. So it's not a kind of a new thing, or New Zealand is not out on a limb. We're doing the sort of thing that happens in Australia and many other places.
How well is the spot price actually working? Some people are getting burned by this price.
Indeed they are, and it's not just consumers. In fact, it's not Rouse major consumers either. It's actually some of the energy companies, the hydro companies, and probably some SOEs, that have to meet fixed price contracts to Ralph customers.
And they don't have the power to do it.
And they therefore have to buy on spot. And some of them will be hurting quite badly. And of course that puts a lot of pressure to try and get somebody else to pay for their loss.
This is the magic of the market.
Indeed.
Ralph.
Yes, well, I mean, the way markets work.
Yeah. And some people are able to sell back to the system, aren't, to the spot market, on the spot market, aren't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, some customers that might have a hedge position might decide, for example, just to cut their own production and just take the hedge value, if you like. I think the interesting thing about the current situation is that the market really is under stress. And the focal point for us is really price, because that should be the indicator as to just how scarce resources are and how close we are. Are we actually to a sort of potential blackout situation? I think the price signals have definitely got better compared to 2001 and 2003, but in our view, there's still some lessons to be learned here. Partly, I think it's the influence of the Whirinaki diesel prices, which we think have distorted perhaps what are efficient pricing signals. And after this current crisis, I think we'll go back and have a look at that. But
why would you have a standby plant that runs on diesel? And when was that decision taken?
2004, yeah. Taken by the government, and they contract one of the power companies to run it for them on their terms. So it was a government decision, and it's government control.
Was it a good decision to have a diesel-powered plant?
I'm probably not in a position to answer
that. What was that driven by? The price of diesel at that stage, or the emissions compared with gas or coal or whatever?
I'm not in a position to
Graham,
answer
you, do you know the answer?
I think it was driven by ideology. It was a political decision. We'll build a standby plant here, and that'll help alleviate the problem. And it wasn't thought through properly. I mean, you had a plant with significantly more capacity than the grid had to get the juice back to the market. So, I mean, that was a blunder from the very beginning. And I agree, it's just all it's done is distort the market. I mean, it's quite handy at the moment, but there are times when Whirinaki starts up because of the way the grid's set up that, you know, one of the wind farms almost gets constrained off the market because a standby diesel plant starts up. Now, that's pretty dumb.
Yeah.
Turning back to prices, though, Chris, there is a paradox, I think, in the Mugg position, that on the one hand, they want prices to be not too high, but in fact, on the other hand, they're saying when
Mugg
things
is
are short,
major users,
Ralph's organisation, is to have prices reflecting the shortage.
Yeah.
That means that prices should go very high in shortage. Yes. And if you're going to run the system we have, you need prices to rise very sharply, and for the people who lose out of that to bear the loss.
Yeah.
And if that's Ralph's members because they're not hedged, that's their problem. If it's the generators because they have got fixed prices, it's their problem.
Your members will all be hedged, won't they, Ralph?
No,
not all of them?
Not everybody's hedged. Rio Tinto took off about 66 megawatts between April through to May, which is quite a significant amount of power. That's because it wasn't hedged. Another company was Panpac, which also has taken off, I think, two or three of its pulping machines. It's got about five.
Mm-hmm.
There may be other large consumers out there that are also unhedged that have reduced demand, although I don't think there is as much consumers not covered as there was in 2001 and 2003. But
That situation's improved out of sight. I can remember back in 2001 and 2003, as soon as things got tight, you could almost predict who was going to be on the news screaming about high spot prices. I used to sit in my office and chortle because I knew very well that some of these companies had been offered fixed price contracts by not only our company but by other retailers as well. And they turned them down. And they turned them down because there were parts of the year where they got their electricity for next to nothing.
Yes.
And it was great. But as soon as the worm turned the other way, they were screaming.
Yes.
And it's like the difference between a fixed mortgage and a floating mortgage.
We need to bear in mind that ordinary customers, ordinary households, don't face a price increase. No one who's in a household or an ordinary customer, or even most people downtown, are not paying higher prices.
And that, at least, is the one element of the whole system which is the most laudable and the most stable.
But they certainly don't. They certainly don't pay the high spot prices in the month that the market is under stress, but they probably will pay for those high spot prices later on when tariffs are readjusted.
All those costs get passed to the consumer. We're running out of time, but I've got one more issue, because, and let's get rid of this once and for all. The nuclear option, which comes up and goes away and comes up again, and some bright spark says, look, it's a no-brainer. All we need is somewhere in the South Auckland area, we need a good nuclear plant, all our troubles will be over. Just very briefly from each of you, Tony, starting with you, how realistic is that? Set aside the politics, just look at the practical aspects.
Look, as a matter of engineering, I'm certainly not in a position to comment on that. I recall that the previous electricity commissioner, Roy Hemingway from the United States, expressed some strong support for nuclear power as a very pro-green option. And as you'd be aware, I think the head of Greenpeace very strongly supports it in Europe. But his view from an engineering perspective was that it wasn't practical from a scale point of view for New Zealand.
Graham?
I think that's the issue. If you're going to build a nuclear plant, it has to be a huge one. New Zealand doesn't need to go down that track. And I mean, some of the people who are regularly out there promoting nuclear, I mean, in the event of a power cut, you put it in the middle of Auckland and they glow so brightly, they probably replace the lights. So, I don't think it's an option New Zealand needs to consider. We've got too many better options.
Ralph?
Absolutely.
In practical terms?
I think we've got lots of other options. We've got wind, we've got geothermal, we've got a little bit more hydro still to be exploited, and we tend to be gas prone, and in the long term we've got coal. So I think we're pretty energy rich. Let's use those resources first.
Nice to talk to you all. I've been talking to Tony Baldwin, Ralph Mathis and Graham Purchase.